This is Tortilla Consal. We're in conversation today with Don DeBar about this week's speeches by Latin American leaders at the United Nations and related events in Latin America and the Caribbean.
I guess maybe we could start with this thing in Uruguay with Philip Morris, because it kind of is emblematic of the new assertion of sovereignty.
I've been putting up a lot of the speeches in Spanish on our website. One of the things that struck me was it was almost as though the Latin American leaders had kind of had a parley prior to going to the UN, because they all dealt with somewhat different aspects of what is essentially the same thing, a very deep criticism of the way United States, but not just United States, also European imperialism has created a world crisis. And they dealt with different aspects of it. And Tabaré Vázquez was looking at, he spent a lot of his speech talking about, he's a cancer specialist by profession. And he spent a lot of his speech dealing with the issue of Uruguay's policy to discourage the use of smoking and tobacco. And from 2010, the government of Uruguay has been subject to a lawsuit from the big tobacco multinational Philip Morris, which is based in Lausanne in Switzerland. And Philip Morris has brought their case against the Uruguayan government under a bilateral trade treaty between Switzerland and Uruguay. There are various levels of interest there. And in 2010, that was just when all the talks about the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the Trade and Investment and Services Agreement, the kind of trinity of ugly sisters, the United States and it's actually United States corporations that have kind of puppet mastering, as it were, the US and European governments and the other governments involved to get these pernicious so-called trade treaties, but they're actually kind of trade in your sovereignty treaties, so that corporations take priority over national interest. And so Philip Morris got in on that early. But now it's become much more obvious. I mean, if they're able to attack the Uruguayan government for sovereign decisions about a very serious public health issue under the legislation that was prior to all these so-called trade treaties, then what would the situation be like if those trade treaties get pushed through? And it puts the withdrawal of Uruguay from the talks about the Trade and Services Agreement in a much sharper light, doesn't it?
Another ironic aspect to it, and certainly a contrast to here in the United States, where you have people dying every day from tobacco and people in prison for smoking marijuana or selling marijuana. If you sell tobacco in the United States, you become fabulously well-to-do, to use Kurt Vonnegut's term. And if you sell marijuana, you become a felon in prison. And in Uruguay, marijuana is completely legal, and tobacco they're restricting as a hazard, the hazard that it is to human health.
Uruguay's policies are very clearly designed to take advantage of their ability as a sovereign country to decide very, very fundamental public health issues. It's also a human right, you know, the right to health. And it's intervening in a way that prevents the pernicious kind of advertising that is the way that tobacco companies have historically used to sell their poison.
And then you had a perfect example of what they call free market capitalism, of, you know, unbridled capitalism, where the entire decision-making process for legislation about tobacco as a public health issue was litigated and or fought out behind the scenes between the insurance industry and the tobacco industry.
Another aspect of this dispute that's interesting is the way that it's being resolved in the Tribunal for Settlement of Investment Disputes that's under the aegis of the World Bank, isn't it? It's an area where corporations can actually have an advantage in many ways over sovereign countries. That's even before all this stuff, all these trade and investment treaties actually get signed and brought into effect. You probably know better than I do what the state is of those negotiations.
I think that's a lot of that's taking place behind the scenes, you know.
Yeah, so much of it is. It's all very, very secretive, and that's why we don't even know at what stage the negotiations are. And apparently the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership turns principally on whether Japan will come on board. And it's not clear whether Japan will or not. Under Abe, it's more likely that they will than they won't. Let's see what happens. Perhaps we should move on. And the other things, I mean, there's one area that we haven't paid much attention to that we should, is the situation in Peru, where this week four people were actually killed in protests against a huge mining project, one of several in Peru. And that's also coming at a time when the Peruvian authorities are engaged in another of these, so apparently, superficially, they look like anti-corruption investigations, this time against the wife of President Ollanta Humala Tasso. And Humala's wife is accused of misuse of campaign funding. She was one of the people that was a key person in the organization of President Humala's presidential campaign. I think we're talking back in 2010, 2011. And she's accused of either embezzling or improper use of over $1 million. She spent 4 hours one day this week giving testimony to the investigating tribunal. So there's that going on in Peru, and that kind of mirrors the kind of thing that's been going on in Guatemala and to some extent in Honduras. But there's also this very serious mining project that in an area in the southern central part of Peru, which is the department of Apurimac. And it involves a project by a Chinese company, a Chinese multinational conglomerate. The project is worth about $10 billion, and it's one of three or four mining projects in Peru that the Peruvian government regards as key to its medium and long-term development strategy for the country. And what seems to have happened is that the original company, a company called Xstrata, China, I think it was a Chinese company back then, that got the concession, undertook to do the project under rules established by an environmental impact study, and then they merged with the US company Glencore, and under China's anti-monopoly rules, they then had to sell off the concession that they'd won from the government of Peru, and they sold it on to another big Chinese conglomerate. But this new Chinese conglomerate doesn't accept the terms of the environmental impact study previously established with Xstrata. And that's what the protests seem to be about. The protests seem to be about the fact that the original environmental impact study had specified that a special route should be built for the transport of material to and from the mine, or to and from the mining area, because it's a huge area, as you can imagine, for a project costing $10 billion. And this new company doesn't want to build that road. It wants to use existing infrastructure, which is completely inadequate for the purpose. This is what the protesters claim. And the other thing that the protesters don't like is that the new owner of the concession wants to build a molybdenum plant that could potentially cause very serious pollution to local water sources. So they're very disturbed about that as well, and that's what the protests have been about. And they've been met with quite serious repression from the local police or under the authority of the Peruvian central government, and four people have died. That's a very, very serious incident in Peru. It's something that is very emblematic of the dilemma that both progressive governments and governments of any political stripe face in Latin America, with the dilemma of how do they develop, how do they promote economic development and maintain an acceptable balance with the environment.
And when you have everybody else in the world, in this particular case, maybe a Chinese conglomerate, but in general, for example, like the National Endowment for Democracy and all of the other little tentacles of U.S. penetration of any governments all over the world, they've actually been very active in Peru, and particularly in connection with a U.S. Corporation that's been mining the largest gold mine in the area. And they actually wasted a lake, Yanacocha Lake.
Right.
And I assume that's in Cajamarca. And I'm assuming that the corruption that the vice president is being, or the president's wife is being accused of, has nothing to do with money from groups like the NED.
Well, who knows? That corruption scandal's going to take its course. And from my point of view, and from the point of view of most people concerned about the development of the region, it's not. It doesn't seem to me to be especially important one way or the other whether the wife of President Humala was actually guilty or what she was guilty of, because I mean, what's that the Peruvian political system is so corrupt, just as the Guatemalan system was, and then what's happened in Guatemala, as we've discussed in previous programs, is that the right-wing president Otto Perez and his colleagues have been kind of booted out of office in what seems to be an internal coup within the Guatemalan right wing, and all that's happened is that another right-wing set of faces is now running Guatemala, with the result of the second round of the election that will happen in October. And in Peru, it's very similar. And Humala originally came to power on a progressive agenda, came under very, very heavy pressure from the entrenched Peruvian right-wing political elites, and shifted his agenda, and now they're really putting the boot in and going after him by way of this case against his wife. Nadine Heredia Alarcón is her name, and she comes from a very wealthy Peruvian family, lots of business interests. But the suggestion that Humala and his circle are in any way significantly more corrupt than everybody else in Peru's ruling elites is a joke. And Peru is the country of Alberto Fujimori and Vladimir Montesinos and Alan Garcia, a previous Peruvian president who's still incredibly in with the possibility of having another run at the Peruvian presidency, and that just Peru's ruling political elites are hopelessly corrupt. And so what we're facing here, looking at in Peru is another of these internal right-wing power struggles about which faction of the right wing is going to come to power in Peru next time around.
That's the same thing, you know. Yeah, I'm going to say it again. I say it almost every time we talk about this, but about the only time that you can rely on a politician telling the truth is when that politician is accusing another politician of being corrupt.
Right. So then there's all that going on in Peru, and it's something that we should try and pay more attention to perhaps over the months to come, because that's a very serious issue, and it'll be interesting to see how Peru manages that dilemma. How do you balance national economic development, lifting people out of poverty, against respect for the environment?
That's a problem facing everyone around the world, from China to India to countries all over Latin America and Asia and elsewhere. The important thing about this fight in Peru is that it's another battleground, really, where the U.S. is looking to leverage itself, in Peru being one of the ones looking at the TPP, for example. And as Colombia starts to resolve its problems, some of the other places where the U.S. has been able to screw around starts to resolve their problems, Brazil starts to get a measure of stability again. Argentina seems to have weathered that little affair with the dead investigator pretty well. Cristina Fernandez was pretty confident and standing on both feet at the UN the other day. Peru's another place where these guys can go in and start monkeying around and look to make trouble for the whole region.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Peru, it's a member of the Pacific Alliance, which is the group of countries that have, in contrast to the countries of ALBA and perhaps Brazil and Argentina, they've really gone heavily for neoliberal economic policies as their route to supposedly lift their countries out of poverty, lift their impoverished majorities out of poverty, as if their elites care very much about that at all. But perhaps in the case of Chile they do, Michelle Bachelet's government. But Chile, Peru, Colombia and Mexico are the four countries of the Pacific Alliance, and they're very much playing off their relationship with the United States and Canada against their relationship with China, and trying to get the best deal that they can within their neoliberal agenda for their national economies. And the United States is probably concerned about Peru from that point of view, because Peru has a very close relationship with China, as this crisis in the mining sector as a result of popular protests demonstrates, because it's a huge Chinese company that's developing that mining concession. So the relationship between Latin America and the Caribbean and the United States is not simply one of the imperialist United States up against progressive governments. It's also the imperialist United States up against new global competitors on their own terms. And that's, you know, that's another challenge that United States diplomacy seems to be failing to meet.
There's yet another contradiction. You know, many of the Chinese companies are have heavy state ownership, but many do not. Some do not, in any event. And when you talk about, for example, a mining company coming in and pushing back against the state, I have to wonder how much Western money is in that mining company.
That was certainly the case with the previous Chinese company, Xstrata, because they had a joint agreement with Glencore, which is this Wall Street-based kind of hedge fund-like company that's heavily invested into commodities and minerals. And as a result of the collapse in prices, and it looks as though Glencore, and I think there are a couple of other companies, there's a company called Trafigura that's involved in commodities heavily as well. And they're probably going to go into crisis. And some people believe that Glencore and Trafigura and a couple of other big companies, these investment companies that got heavily into commodities and now are suffering as a result of the collapse in commodity prices. Some people fear that they may be the next leg into the prolonged financial crisis that is being suffered by the United States and its Western allies. Not because of their commodity investments, but because of the way they're linked into all kind of derivatives and swap agreements, that if they go down, they may bring down a whole rake of other not directly related financial interests across the Western economy, the Western financial economy.
The House of Cards. We have 2 minutes left, but what else do you want to jump into?
And I think it's important to emphasize that the recent series of interventions and speeches in the United Nations from what is essentially a united front of across quite a broad ideological spectrum, because you've got Cristina Kirchner, Dilma Rousseff, Rafael Correa, Evo Morales, Tabaré Vázquez of Uruguay, Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua, all these leaders, Raul Castro of Cuba, all of these leaders are presenting essentially a united front. Very, very powerful arguments against current United States policy in the region. For example, calling for the end of the blockade to Cuba, calling for the return of the Malvinas to Argentina. They're currently a British colony. So despite occasional discrepancies, for example, Guyana's claim against Venezuela, the current dispute in The Hague that's been revived between Nicaragua and Colombia as a result of Colombia's failure to abide by a previous Court of International Justice decision, those differences are very marginal in terms of the way Latin America and the Caribbean is insisting that the United States recognize the new reality that exists in the world. And I think it's going to be very difficult for President Obama or for whoever takes power after the elections in 2016 to resist that.
Yeah, and you know what? That was on display across the board, even outside of the region. I heard yesterday, for example, Angola's president demanding the end to the blockade of Cuba by the United States. Heads of state from almost everywhere expressing solidarity with Venezuela, Cuba, countries of Latin America, India calling for the inclusion of permanent seat for South America and a permanent seat for Africa and on the Security Council. There's something is definitely in motion that is a game changer. And from Washington, they're almost like deer in the headlight at this point. They don't know what to do.